Hello and welcome to another episode of the Scottish Housing News podcast. I'm Kieran Finlay, the editor of Scottish Housing News, and with me is Jimmy Black, my co-host. More than ever before, it seems, global events have played a significant role in shaping housing policy over the past couple of years. The COVID pandemic led to emergency measures on homelessness, rent caps and evictions, while the ongoing conflict in Ukraine prompted efforts to provide homes for refugees. Even the damp and mould in people's homes can be traced back to a hike in energy costs.
So local authority housing officers are tasked with finding solutions to these challenges, all the while managing the inflationary pressures which are impacting their budgets and their tenants. So John Mills, Head of Housing at Fife Council, is the current co-chair of ALACHO, the Association of Local Authority Chief Housing Officers. Now, as a representative body for local authority housing in Scotland, ALACHO has a wide remit of responsibility that stretches far beyond the bricks and mortar of housing management. It's a group of people who, at the top of their profession, come together to share ideas.
So a lot for us to get through then, John, but for those unversed in the activities of ALACHO, can you give us a quick outline of its work and its role within the housing sector?
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Absolutely, ALACHO is a group of chief housing officers representing local authorities in Scotland, and we very much try and act as a learning set for each other, because it's a very challenging role. People are coming in and out all the time of that role, so supporting one another, you know, talking about topical issues of the day. We meet every month at the end of the month, and usually something comes up that we need to really think about, and then come to a kind of policy position. ALACHO is not a political organisation. We're allowed to, as chief housing officers, do that in any case, but you know, Scottish Government, COSLA, and SVHA, and other key players in the housing sector do have a role in advising, you know, giving points of view on particular policy challenges, and trying to find solutions, as you said in your introduction, trying to find solutions to some of the huge challenges we face in Scotland in terms of housing post-pandemic.
Typically, how well attended are these meetings? Has engagement with the chief housing officers themselves and then with the wider sector been given a fresh impetus since the emergence from the COVID lockdowns and the new challenges that have arisen since?
I think it's fair to say that, you know, prior to the pandemic, ALACHO had less meetings than we currently do. During the pandemic, we were meeting every week because of the challenges, because of the emergent issues that we needed to talk to government and COSLA about. We've now gone to a monthly meeting, which is more regular than we were used to meeting prior to the pandemic. But we feel that that is a good network of support for chief housing officers to, you know, just bounce ideas off one another and ask particular questions. And through that, you build confidence and competence amongst that key cohort of local government leads on housing. And through that, you also then are able to give better advice and support to other colleagues in government and housing association movement in particular. So I think yes, the world has changed after pandemic, and so has ALACHO, but we believe we're actually, you know, we get good representation, you know, 20 plus every monthly meeting, but we have a wider network of people who are working to head to housing. We also get shared information through our newsletters, so hopefully people understand what ALACHO is. I don't know how many of your listeners have heard of ALACHO, but that's part of our difficulties. We need to really try and get the message across. Who are we? What are we about? And what are we trying to do? And hopefully that's improving.
Let's get into one of these issues then, the issue of damp and mould. ALACHO jointly published a new briefing on tackling damp and mould in the social housing sector. It must be said that this comes in the wake of the shocking coroner's report, which found damp and mould to be the primary cause of death of two-year-old Awab Ishak. And not long after this report, some housing associations told Scottish Housing News they were bracing themselves for a rise in mould and damp issues as tenants reduced their use of heating systems due to rise in energy prices. Was this briefing always in the pipeline, or have these recent events provided the catalyst for the issue to be taken more seriously?
Oh, I think it's fair to say the shocking death of Oab in Rochdale jolted the sector. I very much liken it to the Grenfell tragedy in London, where the sector stood up and looked at what we do in multi-storey flats. It's the same here, where it shouldn't come to a two-year-old dying because of really, really deep-seated black mould, which hadn't been addressed appropriately by the landlord. So that shocked the sector to say, well, how could this happen in our time, you know, that a youngster has to go through this really difficult situation with respiratory issues. So I think that certainly prompted a series of reviews across local authorities and housing associations. In Fife, for example, I initiated the review, I think it was around about middle of November, once we'd had the coroner's report and we read that report from the coroner. And looked at the circumstances, we said, look, this is not a new problem. It's been around for many years, but our response to the issue of condensation and black mould was clearly not adequate. And I wouldn't suggest that there are similar cases in Scotland, but we didn't know, you know, there was no one actually looking at this systematically. So we have carried out a number of exercises over the last few months. We had an Alacho masterclass just 2 or 3 weeks ago, where a huge attendance from the housing sector. And you know, the good practice guide certainly is a welcome contribution to really getting landlords to stand up and seriously look at what else we can do to try and help tenants mitigate the worst impacts of condensation and dampness. And I think it's exacerbated by the kind of cost of living crisis we're working through just now, where, you know, to adequately heat your home and ventilate your home, which are two of the best ways you can try and tackle this, it's getting really difficult for tenants to afford to heat their homes adequately. So a lot of our attention, as well as reviewing our approach to condensation and dampness, is about stepping up to help people in fuel poverty and give them practical money help and other advice to try and make sure they can continue to heat their homes. But I think what's going to come out in the next few weeks to months is a much more serious approach, systematic approach to helping tenants in all parts of Scotland really get help from the landlords to mitigate the worst issues around black mould.
You could take the view that it's not actually the tenants that need to be educated. It's the people who build the houses, maintain the houses, insulate the houses. I mean, arguably, housing officers have had a bit of a culture of blaming the tenant and not really investigating just quite carefully enough the other potential causes of dampness in the homes. I mean, is that a fair comment?
I don't think that's an unfair comment, Jimmy. I think for landlords, we've been aware of this problem for many, many years. We have sought to help tenants where there's penetrating dampness, for example. That's a fix that you should be able to tackle, because one of our primary legal duties is to make sure our houses are wind and watertight. So penetrating water through roofs, windows, doors, or problematic damp proof courses, they should be easy fixes. And I think that's something landlords are aware of. It's where there's been a move, particularly in the last few years, about increasing energy efficiency, enhancing the air tightness of houses, where there's not adequate ventilation, where tenants are basically struggling to operate new mechanical ventilation systems, and just simply opening windows. So there's a number of things that I think we could educate landlords around, but we could also refresh our information, advice and support to tenants who are in this situation. But we shouldn't blame tenants for a lifestyle. That's not what a landlord should be doing. And I think that is something we were guilty of in the past, and we need to move that culture much more to an advice and support culture rather than trying to blame the tenant. And that came through very clearly in the coroner's report in England, where the landlord had sought to put the blame on the tenant's lifestyle. Now, it's a factor. We can't ignore if you dry clothes on radiators or you do other things in the house to create more condensation or water vapour in the atmosphere, you need to get rid of that some way. And that's where adequate heating and ventilation has to play a vital part. So there are issues about supporting tenants, but also frontline housing officers and other council and RSL officers to make sure that we are helpful and supportive rather than trying to blame tenants.
Is there a role here for allocations to be done differently? Because a house might be perfectly adequate and be perfectly dry for, let's say, an elderly couple, but a young couple taking more showers or with children, it might just not work for them at all. Is there actually scope within the system to be able to pick the right house for the right family?
I think you should always try and do that. You know, I mean, if you've got a family home where mum and dad have brought their family up, family have left, they're left in the house, we should always try and enable them to downsize into more appropriate property and then put a family back in, because we've got an absolutely acute shortage of family accommodation in Scotland. So that's at a premium. The allocations policies in Scotland are heavily influenced by legislation, arguably rightly, and statutory guidance. So to take into account the number of children in a household, the number of, you know, showering hours that family is going to go through in a typical day or week, it's very difficult for us to legitimise that in trying to, you know, give extra points to people with no children to take a particular house. But I absolutely take your point that we need to make sure that houses where there are more showers, baths, pets, more children, etc., we need to make sure that there is adequate heating and ventilation. That's the primary issue here. And if things are not going well for the family, then to step in and actually say, right, here's how we can help you. I think the simple answer to your question, it's a very complicated question, is probably not that we wouldn't really be allowed to take that into account when trying to allocate a property. But you should always be sensitive to, you know, what the household's requirements are, and make sure you've got adequate systems in place to make your condensation and black mould a very minor issue if it occurs, and if it does occur, eradicate it quickly.
Now, you've not mentioned the third pillar, which is insulation, and councils and housing associations are going to have to do a lot of that and to retrofit their houses to the higher standards. What's your view on all of that? How feasible is it to tackle dampness, condensation, mould growth with higher levels of insulation?
I think it is feasible. I think tackling energy use or high energy use in a property is absolutely sound, and you should be trying to help tenants to enjoy their more insulated properties, if that's the right way to put it, so their energy bills do go down. But living in a more airtight house, a more insulated house, brings different disciplines. So you need to understand the problem with condensation and black mould, and with the landlord support, be able to mitigate that. I think the other issue with energy efficiency is we need to do it for the climate emergency. The world is in trouble. But the current way in which the funding for the EASH2 standard, as we call it in Scotland, it's under review just now, but the kind of current funding model is based on tenants' rents contributions going up to fund those works. It's not affordable for landlords and tenants to do that through higher rent increases. So there needs to be a different thinking, different approach to providing more energy efficient homes through national infrastructure funding rather than through rent-based model. And that's what we've been trying to focus our efforts with Scottish Government and COSLA in over the last couple of years. So we're absolutely in favour of increased energy efficiency, but there's got to be education for landlords and tenants about how we can cope with increased, you know, water moisture in homes and get rid of it very efficiently and effectively. So that's the nature of the review that landlords are carrying out just now.
Your first briefing was generally aimed at social landlords. And there's a second one coming up that's going to be directed towards board members and committee members. What role can they play in this?
Well, it's about the overall governance. I mean, if you look at local authorities, councillors are the council, not the officers. And equally with board members of a housing association, they are the housing association. So in terms of governance, all organisations in the social rented sector in Scotland should be carrying out annual risk assessments for the Scottish Housing Regulator. So this is a key part of that risk assessment process that organisations go through throughout the year. So board members need to be informed, trained, supported to be aware of the problem of condensation, dampness and mould, and what the organisation is doing to mitigate that. And that should, in my view, be put into the annual assurance statement provided to the regulator by the end of October every year. So, and the regulator has a role there to ensure that we are taking the problem seriously and we're actually carrying out effective mitigation. So I think that's what's happening just now. I think we need to play it through to this year to the annual risk assessment statements, and the regulator, I'm absolutely certain, will make some statement once those statements go into the regulator by the end of October. So the role of governance in housing organisations, be they councillors or board members, is absolutely vital.
Let's move on to another issue that Alacho has been highlighting, which is homelessness. You've done a thematic review recently of homelessness. It puzzles me, as someone who's been working at various times in my career in homelessness, that it's still going up. We still have more homelessness now than we did before. Why is that, John? Why is homelessness increasing?
Well, the blunt answer to that, Jimmy, is that we don't have enough social rented properties in Scotland. And despite the efforts of government and other agencies to build new social rented homes, it's just not enough. And I think that's something that we're all recognising through the pandemic and aftermath of the pandemic. We've had hikes in inflation, hikes in construction costs. So the new build programmes across Scotland are slowing down if you look at the evidence of new starts and completions. The Scottish Government have recognised the importance of building new affordable homes in Scotland through their Housing to 2040 strategy, which really calls for about 110,000 new affordable homes by 2032. So there is an intention there, there is a vision there, there is a strategy, but all the circumstances that we've highlighted at the start of the podcast about the impact of global events on the housing sector is now starting to take its toll in terms of slowing down those new build programmes. We need to get more social rented homes in the sector for people to enjoy. And when I look back to when I started in housing, look at the decimation of the social rented sector through Right to Buy over those years, a huge number of homes were lost to the private sector. Now, I'm not going to comment on the politics of that, but the deficit that's been left, we're needing to keep building for 20 years to catch up. We also need to buy more homes in the private sector, so local authorities and RSLs are starting to step up their activities. But we also need to make sure that all the empty homes in Scotland, if they're in owner occupation or private renting through a landlord, they're not sitting empty for no reason. And, you know, there is a significant number of existing homes that are empty, which I think is a scandal, really. And we need effective measures for local authorities to bring those back into use. At the moment, we've only got compulsory purchase orders available legally to local authorities, which are cumbersome, they are intensive in terms of timeline, normally 2 years. They are resource intensive in terms of staff within legal and housing. So we've called, Alacho certainly has called on the Scottish Government to really consider compulsory sales orders and bring them forward into Parliament. And I think that is a commitment from the Scottish Government, but we've not yet seen any evidence of that being brought to the Parliament. But we need to find ways and means to get all the people in temporary accommodation currently in Scotland, which is at a record high, into suitable permanent homes. And the only way you can do that is keep building, keep buying, and keep bringing empty homes back into residential use. So I'm not going into the, you know, the underlying factors here, because relationship breakdown, domestic abuse, and other factors play into that. But I think what's happened after the pandemic is the availability of empty housing has gone down in Scotland, and that's causing a break on our ability to move folk on from temporary accommodation. So homelessness is now starting to increase again. You saw the statistics that were published recently by the Scottish Government, and I think that's the direct impact of the cost of living crisis that tenants and other households are going through. So we are in serious times. We need to do something different than just keeping going with what we've got. There's going to be a number of key meetings over the next few weeks with the Homeless Prevention Strategy Group, COSLA, Scottish Government, to try and find a way forward to be a wee bit more radical and innovative in our approach. But it's about getting folk into empty houses. That's the bottom line.
The rapid rehousing policy, which was widely praised over the last few years, has kind of foundered on the rock of COVID, hasn't it? And the lack of available properties to put people in. But is that still a viable policy, trying to get people into out of temporary accommodation and into permanent housing in as fast a way as possible?
Yeah, you're asking someone who's a bit biased in favour of rapid rehousing, because I chair the rapid rehousing subgroup on behalf of Causland Scottish Government. I think it's fair to say that authorities did a great job just in the run-up to COVID pandemic. They were asked to produce a rapid rehousing transition plan within 6 months. They all did it, which was remarkable. And I think the feedback from local authorities is that that's actually produced a foundation for navigating through the pandemic to allow us to do emergency interventions to make people, make sure people were, had a roof over their head, they were fed, they had medicines, and a lot of that work has carried on. I think it's also fair to say that the pandemic was an interrupter to rapid rehousing. If you look across Scotland, some local authorities have turned the corner with rapid rehousing. Some are really making good progress to prevent homelessness and get folk moved on from temporary accommodation. So it's not all parts of Scotland who are struggling just now. I think Central Belt authorities in Scotland are struggling with a number of factors, including Ukrainian refugee requirements, Afghan households, asylum seeker dispersal, as well as a particular crisis in homelessness. So I think it's working in some parts of Scotland where the pressures are not so high and you're able to get ahead of the curve, reduce the homelessness queue in your authority, and to start really getting into prevention of homelessness. And that's the key to rapid rehousing, is preventing homelessness but getting people moved on quickly if homelessness occurs, and not enabling them to stay in temporary accommodation for considerable length of time. So I think there are some authorities who are really struggling, some authorities are doing really well. So the model works, but it needs the right conditions to work.
One last quick question in this area. We now have, you and Fife have a microcosm of the whole of Scotland. You've got big urban areas, you've got extremely pretty areas on the coast and the East Nuke. So you can see that the housing demand is very different across the Fife area. Has the Scottish Government's initiatives and things like short-term lets and licensing Airbnbs, is there any hope that these will have some decent effect in bringing some housing supply back into the market?
I think it's too early to call on short-term let schemes. They were only introduced on the 1st of October last year to local authorities. I think the potential for them having a positive impact in the larger cities such as Edinburgh are more real than in areas like Fife. If you look at St Andrews and the East Nuke and one or two other what I would call holiday hotspots in Fife, it's going to be interesting to see how the short-term licensing scheme plays out. I think it needs 1 to 2 years to enable us to do that properly. At the moment, the number of existing proprietors of short-term lets, they've still yet to apply, a lot of them, because they've had the period extended to September for application by the Scottish Government. So I think it is too early to call. There is another school of thought that once you've got a short-term licensing scheme, then you could actually implement control zones. And that can't be done through the housing legislation, but it can be done through planning legislation. So I think there is an anticipation or an expectation within the sector that introducing the licensing scheme and trying to control the number of short-term licenses in a particular geographical area, that the landlord who owns the property, they may then say, right, okay, I'll go into the private rented sector again, or I'll let out to students through housing multiple occupation. So these are all anticipations or expectations, but the reality is that we're still very short of housing, affordable housing, in the areas I've just mentioned, particularly St Andrews and East Nuke of Fife. So I'm not expecting this to be a magic solution to that. It might be part of a betterment over some time, but it's still too early.
Thanks.
Also in October, the Cost of Living Tenant Protection Scotland Bill was passed and introduced an immediate 0% cap on in-tenancy rents until at least the end of March. Of course, since then, this cap for the social housing sector at least has been lifted, but not until a period of dialogue took place between social landlords and the Scottish Government. Give us a sense of Alacho's role during this period.
Well, we did appreciate that the First Minister and the government felt they needed to take action to protect tenants during this cost of living crisis. So that's the first thing to say, is that, you know, I think we would support government intervention, particularly in the private rented sector, to control rents. What the sector didn't feel was particularly appropriate was for the government to seek to put a cap on social rents. Now, we believe in local authorities and certainly housing associations, that boards and councillors take their responsibility very seriously for setting rents. And there was no one suggesting before the emergency legislation was put into place that local authorities and RSLs were going to be outlandish in terms of rent increases. We're all going to be responsible. So I think that was the major concern we had with the government seeking to intervene in the legal power of local authorities and RSLs to set rents. That's within the legislation currently, that it's up to local authorities and RSLs to set rents. However, that said, we did respond positive to an invite from the Deputy Director of the Scottish Government to convene a short life working group to just hear what the sector had to say, and also appreciate the need for the emergency legislation and how we can work together to try and give assurance to the government that local authorities and RSLs were going to be responsible in setting rents in 23-24. So that short time working group is still ongoing, because I think it's got a job to do in terms of the setting rents within the PRS sector, but also the moratorium on evictions, mm-hmm. which I personally support, in terms of it's not the right time to seek to evict tenants who are maybe in real financial difficulty through energy, food and other inflation. So that short-term working group, Alacho was a member, SVHA, CAH and others, and I think it was a good short working group to actually just hear what everyone was saying and to make sure the Scottish Government's advice and information was right up to date. So, and I think the government did recognise that it was a value to the working group. And hopefully in the future, if any issues like that occur, then it's getting ahead of the curve and letting us know well before any legislation is announced in Parliament. And that's something we would ask the Scottish Government just to be mindful of, is that we are trusted partners, and, you know, give us a shout if there are particular issues that are causing ministers anxiety. Very positively, we can give that advice and assurance that the sector will respond to that.
Yeah, I think the issue, one of the issues was, as soon as you announce that you may be freezing rents, then what happens right before that period is they go up. And I totally understand that social landlords were not in a position to do that because their rents don't go up within that period. But certainly, if there was a whiff in the wind of a rent freeze, then I think
No, I do appreciate that. There was a timing issue, but it wasn't a particularly, you know, impactful on local authorities and RSLs because we don't set our rents until February mm-hmm. each year for the April. What it did do, however, and that was a negative issue, was we were all about to go out or had started our statutory rent consultations right. when the announcement came. And I think it affected our turnouts at events to talk about rents, because most tenants had heard the message from the Scottish Government and decided, well, it's okay, there'll be a rent freeze. So there was that impact on the consultation, which I think was not desirable. So I think that point was taken on board by the government. But you're right. No, I think if landlords have the ability to change their rents the day before an announcement, they'll do that. But that's not appropriate. That's not the way private sector landlords should operate. And I think the social rented sector would totally acknowledge that there needs to be a wee bit more structure to how landlords set the rent. In the social rented sector, we have that structure, and it's actually enshrined in law.
When we were talking about homelessness, you mentioned Ukraine, and Scottish councils have Ukrainian refugees in cruise liners, in temporary accommodation of various kinds, in hotels all around the country, and obviously in people's homes too. Is there adequate funding for councils to deal with what is a really challenging problem?
Well, I mean, first of all, say the tragedy in Ukraine goes on. You know, there's no sign that it will come to an end, and for Ukrainians to return to their homeland. So I think that's the uncertainty surrounding a lot of this at the moment, is we don't know how long the war will carry on. That said, you know, I think the government, UK and Scottish governments, have provided a financial framework to assist private hosts, local authorities, and RSLs to assist with helping housing Ukrainians. Whether that level of funding continues or not is a good question, and we've got our doubts that that is sustainable. Most Ukrainians in Scotland are in either private hosting, which clearly may come to an end at any point and cause homelessness. They're in ships in Glasgow and Edinburgh, and they're in hotels. So what we've not had as yet is a strategy that actually outlines the medium to longer term options, housing options for Ukrainians, assuming the war will not end soon, and folk cannot stay in temporary accommodation, you know, ad infinitum. There has to be an end point to them moving on. I think the two ships, I mean, I think the MS Ambition is embarking end of March, and MS Victoria and Leith is embarking end of June. So there is a time parameter here. There is a problem that we're trying to resolve, but without the adequate housing that we all seek, it's going to be very difficult for us to do that. So that's why I'm saying that we're probably in unprecedented times in terms of all the housing pressures from a different range of needs all coming onto local authorities and RSLs at the same time. And it's very difficult for us to navigate or even deal with one single issue rather than several issues at the same time. So it's going to be very difficult to, you know, satisfy all those requirements within the housing stock that Scotland has.
One thing councils have done is to, well, in North Lanarkshire at least, is to keep multi-storey tower blocks intact that were due to be demolished, do them up to some extent and use them as emergency accommodation. Are there any implications regarding standards, housing quality standards, that this situation is bringing up?
If you look across Scotland, Kieran, I mean, we've got 12 tower blocks. Fife didn't go in for multi-storey flats in a big way in the 60s and 70s, but we've got 12 tower blocks. They're all to SHQS standard. They've all been overclad with safe external walls insulation. So we haven't come to the same view as North Lanarkshire on the future lifespan of multi-storey flats, certainly not in Fife. So we don't have any vacancies in the multi-storey flats, so they're very high demand properties. You do have the normal turnover of empty housing. We have spent a lot of money improving them and getting them up to that SHQS standard. So North Lanarkshire have come to a view through their HRA business plan that they can't invest in those types of housing to the same degree as they would like to do in lower rise housing. So that's a decision for that council. So I'm pretty sure the head of housing, director of housing in North Lanarkshire will make sure that those houses are up to SHQS standard. They won't be at a lesser standard just because they're getting used for Ukrainians. So I wouldn't want to put that kind of message out that it's okay for temporary accommodation for refugees or asylum seekers to be of any lesser standard than permanent housing. It's not. They have to be of the same standard. And in terms of the temporary accommodation standards working group, which has met for some time over the last couple of years, we're going to try and even enhance the standard of temporary accommodation even further to make sure that you know, we can provide decent, affordable accommodation for as many people as need it. So I would say it has to be exactly the same standard, if not even a higher standard.
That Fife Council's policy on high-rises will be music to the ears of my co-host.
Yes, I'm a big fan of multis, and I think we should stop knocking them down. It's just a big waste of very attractive housing accommodation, but yeah. It's all about who you put in them and how you manage them.
Yeah. They're not. We've always had a view that they're not accommodation for children, for couples, for individuals who are more mature. They've maybe had their family and want to move on. Much more manageable, easy to heat, and with good caretaking, concierge, security services. They are safe places to live in, and they're a community. So I've always been a fan of multi-storey flats. We've spent a tremendous amount of investment, particularly after Grenfell, on trying to make sure that they were of a high standard and a very safe standard, and that tenants were reassured that they, they are the place to be for a lot of households in their more mature years, if I can put it that way, Jimmy.
There is another big issue which is hanging over all of us just now, and that is a cut in the affordable supply programme. It was £748 million last year, it's £744 this year, but in the coming year it's gone down to £567.5 million. What was Alatra's response to that?
This was raised at the last Homeless Prevention Strategy Group meeting with the Cabinet Secretary, and although we're in tough financial times and Scottish Government, local government, RSLs have to make sure that they can actually meet a budget requirement within a very constrained financial environment, I think most people did express concern that there was a cut to the affordable housing budget. I think the Cabinet Secretary was at pains to reassure all of us that she was trying to lever in other funding to make up the gap and even more. So that's something that I know they're working on, and we would hope that the level of funding for affordable housing in Scotland has to be increased. Because if you want to reduce child poverty in Scotland, you want to tackle some of the issues within private sector housing, you need more social rented housing. You want to tackle and eventually eradicate homelessness, you need to build more social rented housing. So the argument from Alatra, as well as other housing players, is that we need to see even more money being spent in affordable housing rather than less. But you know, she has given us that reassurance that she is trying to levering other funding. And there's been recent announcements on charitable bond funding, increasing that for housing associations. So, you know, I think there is that awareness at Scottish Government level that they need to keep going with building new housing. And that's a really important national priority.
Well, thanks, John. I think we'll round it up there. If anyone who is not, until this stage, aware of Alatra and the role and how increasingly important they are to Scottish housing sector, they will be now. Thanks to John Mills for coming on. Thanks to Jimmy Black, my co-host, and we'll be back in a couple of weeks.